The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So you may have been thinking that they were up here telling me how to adjust the mic, but what they were really telling me is, don't say this in your Dharma talk. Do say that. Don't say this. You have a reputation for saying the wrong thing. Okay, I'm just kidding. I do have that reputation, but that's not what they were saying. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for allowing me to be with you today. If you've never seen me here before, it's because I haven't been here that many times. I moved here in July and came on Sunday mornings when there's no talk, just kind of easing my way into community and into a new life, having come from Atlanta to here in July. So I feel more at home than ever, and I love it here. I took the train from the Hamlin station down to downtown Minneapolis, and it was about 5:30, and the lights were on, the holiday lights, and people were so friendly and from all over the world, and I just thought, I love it here. And it's cold. Both of those things so are taking place, but I'm glad to be here. So I have not prepared a talk today. I have written here the title of the talk, which I will refer to remind me to stay on track. And the talk is titled, From Dedicating the Merit to Realizing the Merit, Buddhist Chaplaincy as Right Livelihood and Good Medicine. So I guess I want to begin by saying that you have probably engaged in a dedication of the merit ritual. Is that right?
Yeah.
And my understanding from that ritual is that we practice not so that we can become hoity-toity or bougie or spiritually better than other people, but we dedicate the merits of our practice to others so that we're not clinging on to some attainments that we may have experienced in our practice. Is that your understanding?
Of,
yeah. Okay. So one question for us to talk about during Q&A is, what is merit? You know, sometimes when we talk about it, it feels to me like merit is this thing that's out there, some kind of spiritual essence that with my mind, I can then project onto others and change their situation. I hear giggling. Are you giggling at me or with me? So in these days and times in the United States and in other parts of the world too, but in these times in particular, I would really like us to consider whether this thing we call merit is something that's out there like stardust that we can blow onto others and change their lives. Because people are under attack. Many of us, maybe all of us in this room, belong to a group or several groups that are under attack. And I wonder if we sit in our dedication of the merit and leave it at that. I've dedicated the merit. We're good. And there's nothing else that I need to say or do because I have blown that stardust onto others. And they've received it. And voila, they're good. From dedicating the merit to realizing the merit requires more than ritual and good wishes and good intentions, I believe. We can argue about that later. If this is an arguing sangha, I don't know. You know, some sanghas are very conflict avoidant, right? Hopefully this is not that kind of sangha. So I want to say a little bit about who I am so that you know where I'm coming from. I used to be a stockbroker. Yeah, Smith Barney. Solomon Smith Barney is what it was called when I was there. So I was trading stocks, managing stock portfolios, engaging in financial planning, and so on. And one day, as a treat to myself, and this was in San Francisco, so the stock market opens at 6 a.m. or 6:30, closes at 3, I can't remember. It's a long time ago. Anyway, I decided I was going to treat myself on this particular day. I don't know if I made a good sale or a great commission or what, but I'm going to go home early, go home and just chill out. And I decided on this day to watch Oprah. And, you know, sometimes watching Oprah can be really good, and sometimes, well, on this day, it was life-changing for me. She had on her show this boy named Matty Stepanek. Do you know Matty Stepanek? You know, yeah. Oh, this just the sweetest, cutest little boy who was born with spina bifida and spent most of his life in hospitals. But he was on Oprah. He had written this book, Love Songs, I think, books of poetry. I think he was about 11 years old at the time. And he was talking about being in the hospital, being in pain most of his life, but that on his good days or in his good moments, he would gather his collection of books and then take them room to room for the other children to read, or he would read to them. And I just began crying. I just uncontrollably. It wasn't that, oh, that's so cute, you know, eyes. It just came out like a flood. And I couldn't stop it. I probably cried for a good 30 minutes, I'm guessing. And I was all by myself, so I really let it rip, right, and just got into the depths of what this pain was. And what I realized was that 10 years prior to watching that show, I had an experience with my family that was very disappointing. A cousin, first cousin named Rod, who I hadn't seen since we were children, called the family to say that he had AIDS and was dying and had a few months maybe to live and wanted to see relatives before he died. So my mother called and told me this. And I said, oh, okay, so, and I was in law school at the time. I've had many lives. I said, okay, who's going to go see him? And she said, no one that I know of. So I grew up in the United Methodist Church. Okay. And I thought, Christians are supposed to go, this is what Christians say they are. This is what you've taught me to do. This is what you brought, this is what we were brought up to do. Are you telling me Aunt Janice isn't going? Nope. She said he deserves it. Are you saying Uncle Junior's not going? No, he doesn't do that kind of stuff. Are you going? No, I will be there for the funeral. I mean, I just went through relative. So I said, this is unacceptable. This is unacceptable. So I said, I'll go. And I didn't go out of compassion. I didn't go out of love. I went out of Christian duty. Really, that's what I went out of. Like, who would do that? What good Christian would do that, right? So I went. I hadn't seen him in about 15 years. Spent 4 days with him, 4 wonderful days with him. And when I left, he died probably a couple of months later in a hospice organization or facility. I had never heard of hospice before. And so I thought, wow, you mean people do this for complete strangers? They show up for this? And I said, I want to be that kind of person one day. But today, I'm not that person. All right. So put that in the back of my mind. 10 years later, I'm watching Oprah. Matty Stepanek is on it. And the tears just come pouring out. On that day, I resolved then to become a hospice volunteer. This is San Francisco. There were, I think, four hospice organizations that were listed in the phone book. Remember phone books? Yeah. Open the phone book, 1992. Something like that. I don't know. Maybe that's 90. No, a little later. Open the phone book, called all the hospice organizations. One of them listed was Zen Hospice Project. I knew nothing about Zen, nothing about Buddhism. But they said, we have a year-long training program for volunteers. So I thought, well, I need as much training as I can get. So I would like to be part of your program. They admitted me, and that was my first exposure, really, to Zen, to Buddhism, to meditation, and to being able to face my existential angst or crises through the support of Zen Hospice Project. And at the same time, right around the same time, I also received a book called Touching Peace by Thich Nhat Hanh. So those two things kind of came together for me in very powerful ways. So there I was, a stockbroker and a hospice volunteer. Right? Right, yes. Yes. 5 hours, hospice volunteer, probably 60 hours stockbroker. But I soon realized that I'm really looking forward to these 5 hours. I mean, these 5 hours are like gold for me. And the other 60 hours, drudgery. It felt that way once I began working as a volunteer. So what I did with that, ultimately I left the industry. Zen Hospice Project for 1 year then led me to do the Sati Center for Buddhist Studies. Then in the Sati Center for Buddhist Studies chaplaincy program, I said, well, I need to learn more. So I entered the clinical pastoral education program. I said, gosh, I need to learn more. Then I got my master's degree, then became a hospice chaplain, moved from California to Atlanta, entered a pastoral counseling residency for 2 years. Then I've got to learn more, got my doctorate in pastoral counseling, and that led me here. That's how I got here. So I wanted to share all that with you to ask you to reflect on how this practice has impacted you in terms of openness to the suffering of others, caring for others, putting your life on the line, metaphorically and maybe literally, for others. Have you felt a shift? And if so, how has that manifested in your life? Who are the people who've come into your life since this practice who've needed something, a hug, someone to listen to, care, and what's been your response? And how often have you been in that kind of dynamic where you've been open to receiving something that someone wanted to give you in terms of their suffering, and you've been there? And just noticing that, has that now become like part of your life? Or are you at the beginning of it? Or do you have aversion to it? Just to notice, what is this practice? Because this practice, if you immerse yourself in it over and over again for a long period of time, it's bound to have some impact on you positively. Am I right or wrong about that? Can I get a Buddhist amen? Now, sorry, I heard somebody say something. Sadhu, sadhu. Shelley. Yeah. Okay, so I like to play, as you can probably tell. I'm very playful. And when you ask if we should do a chant, and I said, no, let's just, I did come up with my own chant. You want to hear it? Okay. When I say Buddha, you say Dharma. Buddha.
Dharma.
Buddha, Dharma.
Dharma. Okay.
Put that in the community chant book, and you'll never go wrong. Okay. In all seriousness. So how does this practice change us in a way that Buddhism actually does become good medicine? Right? So if you've read the suttas or have read them and contemplated on them, you may recall that when someone said, I would like the Buddha to come visit me because I'm sick, typically the Buddha didn't go. Did you notice that? But the Buddha would send his lieutenants, if you will, Ananda and Sariputta. Okay, wait, I'm sorry, I'm in Vipassana, so it's Sariputta, not Shariputra. Okay, anyway, he would send them. And as the suttas are written, they would almost always first be transparent about their motives for being there by saying something like, we heard that you're sick, that you called on the Buddha to visit. We come with the hope that your suffering is decreasing and not increasing. So that's the intention. And I wonder, just, you know, think about your own practice. Do you think that way when you meet strangers in particular? And if you do, how do they know that, right? Because now, in this political situation we're in, we see a lot of things about ourselves that we probably don't want to see. One is basically, collectively, how fickle we are. Does our morality really depend on who's in power, right? So we're nicey-nice when Obama is president and cruel when Trump is president, collectively speaking. That's what I mean. But since I think we can see that, yes, some people are like that, then what is our response as Buddhist practitioners? Do we come with the transparency that we hope that you're suffering is decreasing and not increasing? And if it is, I'm here for you. What are our ways of saying that? In Zimbabwe, I visited there many years ago, the Shona say, when you ask them, how are you? The response is, I'm well if you're well. You like that? That's powerful, isn't it?
It's like Paul Wellstone. We all do better when we all do better.
Clearly. Truth. Yeah. So how are we operating in the world right now? How are we letting people know you're safe with me? Really, you are, just as you are. I don't care where you've come from. I don't care who brought you here. I don't care why you're here. You're here right now, and so am I. It became very clear to me as I was preparing a Muslim brainstorming meeting on chaplaincy. If you look at some of the websites from the Muslim organizations in the Twin Cities, you'll understand, if you don't already, how they feel about being here right now. It's horrible. It's intolerable, really. How are we making the dedication of the merit a reality in our lives through our thoughts, our behaviors, and our actions? So here's the, if I haven't said anything inappropriate yet, I'm about to, just as a warning. When I think about the few traditions, religious traditions that I'm aware of, one of the things that Buddhism offers and offered 2,600 years ago was a more mentalized system of life, right? Not based on faith, magic, and myth, but more mental, more cognitive, more logical. 2,600 years ago, that was very advanced, right? But there's still some magical elements in it, yeah, that are part of our culture and our practices. And so here's what I'm about to say that might annoy you. I really want us to look at that magical stuff. The magical stuff that keeps us separate from others. Right? For example, I had a conversation once and with a Buddhist practitioner, and the question I posed the question, if somebody's hungry and you have food and they come next, sit next to you, what is the appropriate response? Is it to meditate for their well-being or to give them the food? And they didn't answer the question. They really had to think about what really is the most appropriate thing to do. I think you give them the food, right? So that's probably the most controversial thing I'm going to say today. Realizing the merit is more efficacious than dedicating the merit if you've got to make a decision about it. And you actually can do both. You dedicate the merit, sort of a cleansing ritual, if you will, right? Non-clinging ritual. One that can positively impact our intentions, right? And thus view and so on. But then we have to act on it. To make it real, we have to act. One of the wonderful things about Buddhist chaplaincy, and like I said, I've had many lives, many careers. The thing that's kept me in Buddhist spiritual care is it's so life-giving, compelling, interesting. I'm never bored for some reason, challenged. People are interesting, unpredictable. Growth is unending. There's no, like I said, there's no end to the internet, right? There's no end to growth, I have found in this work. And personally, I don't have the dilemmas that I had when I was a stockbroker about how I was making my money. I feel like I can do this work pretty cleanly. Yeah. It can be exhausting. It can rip you apart and your heart apart. Part of the work then is to make sure that you're taking good care of yourself and that you're supported and cared for. And the good news about this work is that it has really opened up to Buddhist practitioners. Chaplaincy used to be a strictly Christian vocation and profession. Until some Buddhists said, but wait. This is who we are. This is what we do. This is what we care for. This is how we cultivate these aspects. This is the student-teacher relationship. This is what Sangha is. This is what meditation retreats are for. And then those in power in the profession said, oh, can you put that on paper? Seriously. Then there was a Buddhist chaplaincy white, what they call white paper, to help educate the chaplaincy profession about what Buddhists are about. Oh, and that began to open up a path to professional chaplaincy for Buddhist practitioners. Since that time, there have been programs popping up in different places in the country, but not in the Midwest. Right? Is that right? Not in the Midwest. Yeah. Until now. Yeah. I came out here for a reason. You think I came out here to freeze my you-know-what off and not do good work? No. So we are at United in New Brighton really recommitting to interreligious chaplaincy, really recommitting to it. Our graduates in our Masters of Divinity Interreligious Chaplaincy Program are expected to graduate being relatively proficient in ministering, if you will, to people from a variety of faith backgrounds. And also, we want to create programs for people with specific religious interests. So you may have heard or not, on Friday and Saturday, this coming Friday and Saturday, can you believe that? Patrice will be teaching an introduction, you know Patrice?
Yeah.
Yep. We'll be teaching an introduction to Buddhist pastoral spiritual care and chaplaincy workshop. And this will be the first of six. We have 14 people who've already registered.
There's a poster downstairs with links that you can take out a little paperclip downstairs about this on the community bulletin board downstairs.
Great, thank you, Patrice. So as far as I know right now, we're probably going to have six or seven workshops led by practitioners from various traditions, Zen, Insight, Shambhala, Community of Mindful Living, Thich Nhat Hanh. And I invite you all, if you're interested in pastoral, spiritual care, chaplaincy from a Buddhist perspective, that you join us. So those are just some thoughts I wanted to share with you and introduce myself. We have time for comments and questions. It's the Olympics. People, we just crossed the finish line, right? Everybody gets a medal. Okay. Would you pass this behind? Okay, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Is this on?
Yep.
Thank you for your talk today. Hope I won't get you in trouble with a question.
Okay.
I guess there is a hypothesis that the historical Buddha was an enlightened being. One thing that I really have trouble sitting with is some of the gender imbalances in the original Sangha, mm-hmm. particularly who held power and the fact that, as I understand it, women were originally not included in that Sangha. Mm-hmm. So how do you sit with some of the historical realities of the Buddhist practice with the pretense of enlightenment?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
No, you're not. You've been waiting for the right person to come and ask that question. So I have a variety of responses. Yeah. I taught a Women in Buddhism class at the University of the West in Rosemead, California, about a year ago. And this was a great opportunity for us to really look at how women were treated in various Buddhist communities in different countries at different times. So initially, he was not enlightened about women. That's my response. But my understanding is that his adoptive mother, right, said, I want to be in the Sangha, and kind of wore him down. Right? And then she said, y'all, come on. Right? So other women formed, because it was actually safer for them to be in the Sangha than it was to be a woman in Indian society at that time. But then the Buddha said, yeah, but see, here's the thing. We're men, we're trying to be celibate, and you all coming in here is going to make it really difficult. So we're going to put some additional law rules on you, women, right? Because the thought was, women are the problem, right? Men aren't the problem. Women coming with all their sexiness, right? Coming into the Sangha to get us stirred up. So if you want to be here, this is how you're going to have to live, right? In some places, and then in other places, it even got worse. Japan, in particular, this blood hell that women were, all women who menstruated, were considered polluters, right? And therefore, upon death, some written thing would be put into their burial vessel, condemning them to the blood hell, where they would be forced to drink all the menstrual blood in hell. Right? Horrible, horrible. Here's what I'm thinking now. If you look at almost all the major religious traditions, you will find that men did not understand women. And today, still, men tend not to understand women, generally speaking, in this culture. I would like to go off on a tangent since you opened this up. Okay, so I saw yesterday in the news that Steve Bannon, for some reason he still gets press, said that the #MeToo is undoing hundreds of years of history because it's anti-patriarchy. So here's the point. You can't undo history. Right? There's that, right? History cannot be undone. The Buddha's not understanding about women cannot be undone, right? The question is, what do we do now, right? And it's an opportunity for us to revitalize humanism in Buddhism. And notice when we are reverting somehow to these old misogynistic, and they are misogynistic teachings, right? Are we trying to impose that here? And if that's what's happening, then someone needs to say, that's not acceptable. That's not who we are. That is not enlightened. That's my thought.
Thank you.
Yeah, can I get a Buddhist amen? Yeah, okay. Sadhu, sadhu.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Dan. Thank you for your talk. One of the things I've discovered over time with the practice is it's, and this has really been important and powerful for me, is that it's made me open and comfortable to, when I'm choosing to help or try to, you know, be in the space of somebody, being comfortable regardless of the outcome. My impulse is to help. It's always been that way, good Catholic boy and all that sort of thing. And so that, yeah, I don't have to reach far for that, but it's the reasons why I do it. And it's not like with a nefarious angle. It's just like, this is what I do. And kind of like what you were talking about earlier. And I found by not having to rely on that and actually be able to step away from it, it's really quite powerful because I get in touch with really, what I'm experiencing at the moment. Sometimes not, you know, I have to just, it is what it is. A couple of years ago, I was right after Common Ground, about two blocks east of here. I was on a walk with my dog and went by, it was in the spring, and this guy was in the alley trying to stay warm with a tarp over the exhaust at a building. And, you know, I saw that and I go, God, that doesn't look good. So I pulled $5 out of my wallet thinking, well, at least he can get something to eat and maybe warm up. And I walked up to him, and he was under the tarps. I had to tap him, and I shocked him, and he wouldn't take the money. He wouldn't hear of it. And, I kind of stepped back, and years ago, that would have kind of bummed me out, and, I had to think about it for a second, but I just thought, okay, that's him. I don't know why, the whole thing about having pity, I introduced that here, is a real divide for both the recipient and the giver. And there was probably a little bit of that, but my main thing was just, I'd like to see him be healthy. And I just sat with it, didn't really have a clear answer than the fact that it is what it is. And I felt fine with that. And I'm able to do that a lot more, especially when I get into situations of the unknown, that if I can just hug my own reaction, regardless of what it is, there's an unleashing of better stuff that comes out of that. So that's it in a nutshell. So
thank you. Thank you. Hugging your reaction. I love that. Thank you.
Welcome, Ayo.
Thank you.
It's
thank
so
you.
Wonderful to have you here.
Thank
and
you.
I got so much wisdom out your talk, but before I make my question comment, I just want to make some observations. And, you know, I've been coming here for many Sundays, and my primary practice time at Common Ground is on Sundays, and sometimes I go to the POC group. But I come here on Sundays, I'm overwhelmed with this knowingness in my body that this is a white body supremacist space. And when I say that, it means that myself and other folks who look like me will be kind of isolated in relation to kind of this space. And it also means that the tendencies and ways of being a whiteness in this space is very evident, right? All right, y'all, don't get too upset. Don't get too tense because I can feel the energy. But what I see and what I noticed, you know, by being here and having blackness and femaleness in the center of this space and in the center of the Dharma and offering kind of Dharma is that things changed. So people started doing different things with their bodies. First people, you know, like, and then we had call and response that came out simultaneously. And then we had laughter. And so some of the energy that, you know, we think about mindfulness and this kind of mental aspect that you described of Buddhism was, I feel like, brought down a little bit more to this different kind of space, which gives us access to new kinds of knowledge about Dharma. So first, so thank you for that. And thank you for coming. And I hope to see you again. So what I want to say is, like, thank you for this talk on right livelihood, because one of the things that you notice, like, if you try to put, like, your practice in a schedule, like, okay, on Sunday mornings I'm going to be here, on this time I'll be here, and 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning I'm going to be here, and you do your practice and you meditate, but then you go back into this world where you got to fight traffic, and we won't say nothing about traffic, mm-hmm. You got to go to work, you have to do all this stuff. It's kind of like there's this question about, all right, is this for you? I mean, we need to build our own merit for our own sake, or is it for others? And I find that, like, listening to you talk, there's a way in which you could keep off of that kind of pendulum and really connect our livelihood and our lives to merit and bringing that into the spaces where we are and really being conscious about that in the space. And so for that, I thought it was like a really kind of great lesson on right livelihood. And okay, I'll stop talking, except for my question would be, yeah. So yeah, we really, oh, the children are here. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, the children are here. So.
Oh.
Not appropriate. They're going to come up here.
Okay. Do I need to move?
They sit on the side.
I'm going to do a different kind of chant.
Hi.
Hi, guys.
How are you? Good.
Around you.
Yeah, I love it. Hi.
So we usually close by singing a song. Okay. You ready? Sing. And a one, and a two, and a three.
Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. I am blooming as a flower. I am fresh as the dew. I am solid as the mountain. I am firm as the earth. I am free.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.